how would an alien communicate with us? Maybe it would be as Envision and Contact, or maybe it would be something radically different.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks. Welcome to the program, one and all. Glad as always to have you along for the ride as we go spinning cosmogirally through space and time like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time right here on KGRARadio.com, our home here on the web. Lots of news to cover as always, including a few updates of the cryptozoological kind. Some rather interesting news imparted to me quite randomly over the weekend, and also a full report on an event that I attended with some of my cohorts. That's right, the Marian Sasquatch Festival. That was quite an interesting cultural experience. But we've also had earthquakes rocking the Carolinas. We've got an ex-Google worker who is really worried right now about killer robots. We also have some Area 51 updates, news about a new interstellar object that astronomers believe they have detected. And then later in the program, touching on a number of subjects in science today, but one that is near and dear to my heart and his, the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That will be Dr. Brian Keating, who joins us with news and views and a few perspectives on that and other subjects, including the Nobel Prize season, which is on its way yet again. Lots to get into, and also a few listener emails. We are long overdue. I've got a lot of correspondence from you guys to get to. I hope everyone is doing great, by the way. And from time to time, I like to remind my listeners that I really mean that when I say that. And like most self-employed people, I tend to get really busy, but I try to respond to emails when I have time. And I've formed friendships with so many of you guys out there over the years. And although I may touch on this again a little during the listener email segment, I like to remind the audience from time to time how important it is for me to be able to hear from you guys. Getting news tips, getting emails, personal correspondence, you know, opinions about things, hearing from you folks. And again, like I've said, I've made so many friendships over the years as a result of doing this program. That's one of the best and even one of the most profound things about doing this show. So I always like to tell you guys that. Make sure that you know I appreciate all of you out there. And it means a lot to me to be able to have those interactions. My audience in general means a lot to me. And I've seen a lot of podcasts, keeping in mind, of course, that this show, even with a name change, has been an endeavor, and with the associated GraylianReport.com website, that has been more than a decade in the making. And I've seen a lot of podcasts since I began that show up on the scene, they make a big splash, but you can tell pretty quickly that A, they don't continue to put in the effort over time, or they begin to lose interest and they don't maintain the consistency of their podcasting schedules and things along those lines. Sometimes they also just run out of things to talk about. And all of that to say, it takes a lot of work to be able to keep a show fresh, to keep finding new subjects, new topics to address, new perspectives on old ones. Fundamentally, maintaining a passion and an interest as a host of a podcast, that in itself can be difficult. And yet I enjoy doing this show as much, if not more at times, than I did when I first began. I've learned so much from being a podcaster. I learn so much from my listenership, the stories and the perspectives that you guys share. So I appreciate all of you out there. And it's just truly special to me to be able to share in this dialogue and to enjoy the experience of doing this podcast with all of you every week, going on for 10 years. And so right here at the outset, just wanted to send some really good vibes out there to you guys, and more importantly, to express my thanks and appreciation for having so many of you out there who participate in various ways. Even if you are a longtime listener, you've never written in or anything along those lines, you're not a subscriber, but you listen to the show and you appreciate it, that is as meaningful as anything. Because rather obviously, you can have a great podcast you produce, but that doesn't mean anything if you don't have listeners. To the thousands of you out there who participate through listening, thank you. That means the world to me. So on that note, we will jump right into the news, because although I was doing a little travel right here in North Carolina over the weekend, there was also news in the last few days about a series of small earthquakes that have been rocking one particular North Carolina community. And according to the Charlotte Observer, they say that one area of the North Carolina mountains, according to the USGS, had six small earthquakes. Those quakes have all been within a couple miles of each other near Cherokee, North Carolina, in the Great Smoky Mountains. Now, that's not uncommon, because we do exist right here in North Carolina along what's called the Brevard Fault. And so earthquakes do occur from time to time. In fact, just a couple of years ago, I've been laying awake early in the morning before the sun rose. Not an uncommon occurrence for me, especially coinciding with a full moon like what we've had here over the last few days. But I had been laying awake and I felt my entire house shaking for a moment. And I thought, what in the world was that? And sure enough, the very next day, the USGS had reported a small earthquake right here in my region. The fact that the earthquakes occur here along the Brevard Fault, in fact, has even been proposed as one possible explanation or a mechanism at very least in relation to the Brown Mountain Lights that are seen down around the Linville Gorge. But coming back to Cherokee, according to the USGS, they say the biggest quake of this series of six was a 2.5 magnitude trembler that occurred on Wednesday night at about 11:30 p.m. In fact, we have dates and times now for all of these. The first occurred on September 7th at about 8:14, then on September 9th at 4:21 a.m. We had another that same day, but at 3:08 p.m., and then on September 11th, there were three of the tremblers, the first occurring shortly after 8 p.m., and then we had two between 11:03 and 11:14 p.m., Now, the Charlotte Observer reports that the earthquakes were all low intensity. From the strongest trembler, 44 people reported feeling the quake to the Geological Survey. Only a handful of people reported feeling the other earthquakes, according to the USGS. I have to say, I would be interested in hearing whether anyone out there in the Cherokee area had seen any strange lights with the prevalence of tremblers occurring around that time. And in fact, that reminds me of something kind of interesting that my friend Laura, who had joined me at the event there in Cherokee a few weeks back, had told me, because we had been discussing the Brown Mountain Lights and I had said that there were no Cherokee traditions that explicitly reference those lights. And although there are a lot of writings from over the years that claim that there are Cherokee legends about the lights, those didn't appear in writing any earlier than the first reports of the lights, which began to occur in the first couple of decades of the 1900s. But Laura sent along this account from James Mooney, anthropologist who had gathered a lot of the myth and folklore pertaining to the Cherokee. And this one was titled, What the Stars Are Like. And it reads, there are different opinions about the stars. Some say they are balls of light, others say they are human, but most people say they are living creatures covered with luminous fur or feathers. Now, one night a hunting party camping in the mountains noticed two lights, like large stars moving along the top of a distant ridge. They wondered and they watched the light until the light disappeared on the other side of the mountain. So the next night and the next, they saw the lights again moving along the ridge, and after talking over the matter, decided to go on the morrow and try and learn the cause. In the morning, they started out and went until they came to the ridge, where, after searching some time, they found two strange creatures about so large, making a circle with outstretched arms, with round bodies covered with fine fur or downy feathers, from which small heads stuck out like the heads of terrapins. The account in this legend goes on to say that as the breeze played upon these feathers, showers of sparks flew out. And so the hunters carried the strange creatures back to their camp, intending to take them home to the settlement on their return. They kept them several days and noticed that every night they would grow bright and shine like great stars, although by day they were only balls of gray fur, except when the wind stirred and made the sparks fly out. They kept very quiet and no one thought of their trying to escape, when on the seventh night they suddenly rose from the ground like balls of fire and were soon above the tops of the trees. Now, in addition to that being kind of a cute legend about the origin of stars, it was interesting, and I think what caught Laura's attention had been the fact that there is the mention of the stars being seen moving across the top of a ridge. It's probably merely folklore, but the description given in that mythology pertaining to the quote-unquote stars, which nonetheless are explained as furry creatures that can fly and glow in the dark, that description of the objects moving over the ridgeline night after night is interesting nonetheless. And I wonder if that folklore, that mythology, that story, that account given to James Mooney could possibly have any kind of basis in actual observations of earthlights that were made by the Cherokee centuries ago. And in fact, if in ancient times there were lights that were seen in the sky much closer to Earth, that North Americans in pre-Columbian times might have likened to being stars, but much closer and moving through the sky. If indeed they were observing something like that, that might have actually fueled the mythology that became appended to them as these things being creatures or something along those lines. And again, as cute and kind of quaint as that idea is, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that there may have been at some time long ago some observational data that kind of fueled those belief systems. And so although that's not explicitly a reference to the Brown Mountain Lights, that's a very interesting Cherokee legend I'd never seen before that Laura sent along that could even be worthy of further consideration in relation to Earthlight phenomena. But again, with all of the tremblers occurring out there in Cherokee right now, I would be interested in seeing if any similar nocturnal luminous phenomena appears to have occurred. If you happen to live out that way and you've seen anything, of course, we've got an international audience, but if you happen to be that close to our headquarters here in the mountains, I'd like to hear from you. info@micahanks.com is the best way to reach me. Heading over into other news, I've mentioned that there was an ex-Google worker, and we've touched on some of this in the past. Google workers who have quit in protest of Pentagon projects that Google employees are not even allowed to know anything about, but which have to do with the potential for creating destructive technologies and weaponry, even artificial intelligence, in the future. And The Guardian reported on this recently, noting that Laura Nolan, who resigned from Google last year in protest at being sent to work on a project to dramatically enhance U.S. military drone technology, has called for all AI-killing machines not operated by humans to be banned. Nolan said killer robots not guided by human remote control should be outlawed by the same type of international treaty that bans chemical weapons. And she says, unlike drones, which are controlled by military teams, often thousands of miles away from where the flying weapon is being deployed, she said killer robots have the potential to do, quote, calamitous things that they were not originally programmed for. Now, one thing we have to take into consideration is that we see a lot of leading technologists these days, like Elon Musk, weighing in on the potential concerns they have about AI. That's one thing. What we're discussing here are Google employees who have quit in protest of this so-called Maven program. Many of the aspects of the program have not been disclosed to the employees who were working on it, and not only did they have a concern about some of the existential threats it might produce, but also the fact that the Google company seemed to be working in secret with the Pentagon, and even the employees that were helping with the program, they weren't made fully aware of what kinds of things they were working on. That's part of what caused the controversy. But I can't help but think that if someone like Nolan quit in protest and specifically references killer AI or killer robots and things along those lines, does she actually have more knowledge of the kinds of things that she specifically had been working on? And hence, this is what in large part informs her concerns. Now, again, The Guardian reports on this. And note that Nolan, who has joined the campaign to stop killer robots and has briefed UN diplomats in New York and Geneva over the dangers posed by autonomous weapons, said, and I quote, "The likelihood of a disaster is in proportion to how many of these machines will be in particular areas at once. What you are looking at are possible atrocities and unlawful killings even under laws of warfare, especially if hundreds or thousands of these machines are deployed." She goes on to say that there could be large-scale accidents because these things will start to behave in unexpected ways, which is why any advanced weapons system should be subject to meaningful human control. Otherwise, they have to be banned because they are far too unpredictable and dangerous. Now, one of the examples she gives is, how would a drone that is targeting and killing people autonomously, how would it differentiate between an armed insurgent and a young boy out in the woods hunting? These are some of the questions that she raises. The Guardian also notes that Google recruited Nolan, who is a computer science graduate from Trinity College in Dublin, to work on Project Maven in 2017 after she had been employed by the tech giant for 4 years, becoming, in fact, one of its top software engineers in Ireland. Now, she said that she became increasingly ethically concerned over her role in the Maven program, which was devised to help the U.S. Department of Defense drastically speed up drone video recognition technology. And I have one more quote from her. Nolan said, "I'm not saying that missile-guided systems or anti-missile defense systems should be banned. They are, after all, fully under the control of humans, and someone is ultimately accountable. But these autonomous weapons, however, are an ethical as well as a technological step change in warfare. Very few people are talking about this," she says, "but if we are not careful, one or more of these weapons, these killer robots, could accidentally start a flash war, destroy a nuclear power station, and cause mass atrocities." I agree. I think this is something that we should be looking at. But again, the most concerning thing is this was one of the lead computer scientists in Ireland who was working with an international team assisting Google with improving these kinds of video recognition technologies. And it would be another thing altogether if she's merely saying, purely in a speculative sense, this stuff could be on the way, we should be worried about the potential. I mean, really, that is what she's saying. But again, coming from the background, having worked on these programs, having quit in protest, and of course, she's not the only one, many others more concerned about the fact that Google wasn't giving them enough information about explicitly what these technologies were, what they might entail, what they might be used for by the Pentagon. And on the Middle Theory podcast, I've talked a lot in recent weeks about my concerns about some of the relationships that U.S. intelligence and the military have been building with Silicon Valley and with the tech industry. We look at the Pentagon's connection with Jeff Bezos and the fact that Jeff Bezos and Amazon, they are really trying to lobby to provide all kinds of infrastructure for the Pentagon, for the U.S. military, even right down to the state level for U.S. law enforcement. They're utilizing facial recognition technologies and other technologies that don't seem to have any kind of real regulatory oversight. Amazon's also been developing and distributing to law enforcement video surveillance systems where people can have cameras installed on their front doors for home safety and surveillance. This is completely an opt-in kind of thing. But in addition to simply having the cameras on their doors, people can also opt in to allow law enforcement to have access to those cameras. And I can't help but think, as I've said on the other podcast, we look back to Dwight Eisenhower and how Dwight, as he was leaving office, gave that famous historic speech warning us about the military-industrial complex. And they said that Dwight, again, a military hero himself, he would get really angry when he looked at popular magazines and he would open them and he would say there were full-page ads promoting the creation of new kinds of warfare, aircraft and weapons systems and things like this by private industrial entities that provide these things for government use. He said, I didn't like seeing advertisements for weapons and implements of war in magazines. And they said that he, if he saw those kind of ads in magazines, that he would throw them into the fireplace. And that was exactly the kind of connections between the military and the industrial side of things that he was warning about. But in Eisenhower's day, we didn't have the kind of technological presence that we have these days. The tech industry and its association with the military is a whole new side of that coin. And we really do need to be aware of those potentials, especially when we have these former Google employees saying, this is what we were working on. We need to be very, very careful as we move forward. And certainly there is a case to be made for secrecy. Much government secrecy is carried out in the best interest of the American people and people abroad. But that's not always the case. And I'm also a real fan of transparency, sunshine laws, that sort of thing. I do like to know when the government is planning and proposing to build killer robots. That's something I think a lot of us would like to know about. Okay, so Area 51's in the news too. Let's shift gears here, because apparently the big event that has been talked about so much, talked to death in fact, that's right, the Storm Area 51 event was canceled. But that didn't keep a couple of Dutch men from going and trying to film things there at the base. DutchNews.nl reports that two Dutch men have been arrested in the U.S. for trying to enter an area of desert in Nevada known as Area 51, which is controlled by the military. Area 51, around 120 miles north of Las Vegas, is home to a heavily guarded U.S. military base. According to UFO conspiracy theorists, and the article goes on to say it's also the home of the famous Roswell wreckage, the alleged flying saucer said to have crashed at Roswell back in 1947. Now, on that note, I think we should probably explain here that while people like Bob Lazar, who claims to have actually worked at the S-4 facility, while he claimed that he had seen a number of different flying saucers and he had been told that these objects had been recovered, some of them during wreckages, I don't know that there was any explicit reference to Roswell made. I think that the modern connection with Roswell probably stems from stories like those, which I've talked about with Nick Redfern in the past, stemming from Annie Jacobson, who concludes her book on Area 51 with a rather sensational story about a Russian hoax basically perpetrated against the U.S. military, made to look like a UFO crash that occurred at Roswell. And that aspect of the story is probably why Roswell would be tied to Area 51, whether or not there really is much evidence that ties those two. But coming back to these two men in the Dutch report here, they had apparently gone to Area 51. They had a drone, a camera, and they had laptops with them in the car they were driving. They were arrested on Tuesday, 3 miles inside the security zone, after telling police that they had seen the signs but wanted to look at the site anyway. Both men have several YouTube channels with tens of thousands of followers. Subscribers to one of their channels are told that he travels around the world in search of the most challenging adventures. So a word to the wise, as we've reported in the past, if you are headed out there toward Area 51 and you see those signs, some of which over the years have even implied that deadly force may be used, you don't want to enter Area 51. It's not a good idea. But on that note of Area 51, there was a news brief out of Las Vegas the other day with a quote from author Bill Yen, and he wrote a great book on Area 51 black jets, which I actually have a copy of. And he said people who do spend a lot of time on the mountaintops there in Las Vegas report all manner of shapes and sizes of aircraft and the lights in the sky performing in amazing ways, maneuvers, and speed. And Yen said that if you do see those things, you are literally seeing an unidentified flying object. However, Yen says a number of secret spy and military aircraft have been developed and tested at Area 51 and the neighboring Tanapa test range for decades, fueling the belief that extraterrestrial UFOs exist. Now, that brings to mind a very important point, the potential connection between extraterrestrials and sightings of unidentified flying objects. If you really look at the history of these sightings, the idea of an extraterrestrial presence was not something that the military in their early studies had ruled out, but it certainly had been popularized primarily by one researcher, a former Air Force officer himself by the name of Donald Kehoe. And Kehoe really popularized the idea. In fact, he wrote books with titles like Aliens from Space. And even though the military, and more importantly, the U.S. Air Force's own Project Blue Book, took Kehoe's attitudes with a grain of salt, it was his writing on the subject, and also his background with the Air Force himself, that kind of popularized the extraterrestrial idea in relation to UFOs, and also brought a degree of credibility to that notion. Well, this guy worked for the Air Force. Of course, that's a possibility. And I think although that possibility remains true these days, I have in recent weeks received some pushback from listeners from time to time. I've had folks write in, and they perceive my inherent critically minded attitude toward the UFO subject, which I would like to say for my own part, is critically minded but open to all possibilities pending further evidence. But I've had pushback. Folks say, you're so critical about that subject, you just come across like you're talking down to your listeners. Well, let me please say, first, if I've ever come across that way, that's not my intention. As I've said at the outset of this episode, in fact, I have so much respect for so many of you out there, people who constantly share your own ideas, many people in academic circles who are brave enough to address this subject and even speculate about possible extraterrestrial components to it. I have tremendous respect for academics who are willing to entertain that idea, and I entertain that idea too without committing to belief in it. But I had another listener write in and say that you are so unwilling to entertain the ET hypothesis, it must be your religious upbringing, and you have, despite saying that you are very open-minded, you have a tendency to fall back into old religious thinking, and so you're probably not very willing to be open to the idea that extraterrestrials exist. Which, I have to say, is kind of an odd argument to me, that I would be inherently skeptical of UFO sightings, and their interpretation as being evidence of alien visitation, because I'm secretly religious, and more so than I let on. I mean, I can tell you from my own perspective, that's really not what I believe, but it's interesting to me, self-contradictory though that argument appears to be, it is interesting to me that folks have looked at the way I try to report very credibly, very cautiously on the UFO subject, and many interpret it in a variety of different ways. In other words, I think those who are prone toward acceptance of an ET hypothesis see me as being too critical. But then I'll see the skeptically minded critics coming after me and saying, well, his willful belief in UFOs, he talks about them on his program. Quite obviously, he believes they must all be one thing and that they do exist, whatever that is. That's one of the more interesting aspects, I guess, of all this, is seeing how different people not only interpret the phenomenon, but how they interpret other people's presentation of that data. I'll tell you somebody else who has caught a lot of heat recently for similar things. That's John Greenwald of the Black Vault. And John Greenwald, I think, has really done incredible work over the years appealing to government agencies using the Freedom of Information Act and obtaining documentation that discusses mostly UFOs, but he has dealt with everything from MKUltra to, yes, the Bigfoot files from the FBI that we reported on earlier this year. It had been John Greenwald who requested those documents from the FBI and received them almost a year prior to them being posted at the FBI's website for the general public and then being reported by CNN and all these other news agencies. Point in case, there are thousands of documents that John has managed to obtain over the years, many of which have to do with the UFO subject. And in John's opinion, there is indeed, to him, something of a cover-up by the U.S. government. He doesn't think that the U.S. government is forthcoming completely with all of the information it has on this subject, based on his own inquiry over the years. But because John is also inherently critically minded, I would say that he and I are very alike. And in fact, I happen to know that because I've spoken to him at length on the telephone about this. And in fact, we hope to do that again this week. And I do want to try and get him on the show. We're just both really busy. But when I do eventually get him on the show, we'll talk even more about this. But I feel that John and I are very much of like mind. And once the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program made news in 2017, this was a real game changer in UFO studies. But John Greenwald had certain concerns because of, as we've reported in the past, there appeared to be discrepancies between some of the accounts given by some of the key players, namely Lou Elizondo, who was the alleged head of that program. Now, because of some of those discrepancies, John has continued to reach out to the Pentagon for statements. And this is where things get really interesting, because in doing so, he recently received a statement from Joseph Gradisher, official spokesperson for the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Warfare at the Pentagon. And Greenwald had been asking a few things. One, he wanted to know whether the famous pieces of footage, three of them released by the To the Stars Academy, formed by Tom DeLonge, had been officially cleared by the Navy for release. And he also wanted to know whether the Navy had any official perspectives on what the objects in those videos may have been. Now, in previous statements to Greenwald, the Navy had further emphasized the fact, as has been told to journalist Keith Clore, writing for The Intercept. In fact, I plan to speak with Keith Clore on the telephone later this week, but Keith Clore had been told by the Pentagon, same Pentagon spokesman, in fact, that Elizondo had no responsibilities when he worked with ATIP, which is indeed rather confusing if he was supposed to have been the head of the program. John Greenwald, also trying to find out and establish the provenance of these videos, was told by Gradisher not only that they had not been cleared for release, and this is exactly what he said, according to a quote provided by Greenwald at the Black Vault website, the Navy designates the objects contained in these videos as unidentified aerial phenomenon. However, the Navy also asserts that the three videos were never cleared for public release, thus confirming, according to Greenwald, the official stance of the Pentagon originally issued to the Black Vault in May of 2019 and contradicting the TTSA's widespread claims that the government declassified the footage for public consumption. And in terms of that earlier statement provided by the Pentagon, this was from spokesperson Susan Goh back earlier this year. She had told Greenwald that, quote, the videos were never officially released to the general public by the DOD and should still be withheld. I believe she had said something similar in a statement given to Politico. Now, why is all this significant in the broader discussion of the UFO subject? Well, here is what most people seem to have missed. And this, of course, was a point that was raised by my pal Tim McMillan, good friend of mine and John Greenwald's, during a call the other day. This seems to have been the first time, in relation to these videos or in any other instance, where specific footage that has been acknowledged as being footage from the Navy, whether or not it was officially cleared for release, we do seem to believe that this video originates from the U.S. Navy, but the Navy acknowledges not only that, but also that the objects in those three pieces of footage cannot be identified. This is what they tell John Greenwald. And as Tim pointed out, he said, look, this may be the first time in history that the Navy has ever had a video which it says, yeah, that comes from us. It shouldn't have been made public, but that was ours. And we don't know what those things in that video actually are. Now, here again, I did a quick piece about this at GraylianReport.com. And if you head over there, you'll see that article, which gives further details and also links to John's lengthier report over at the Black Vault. But the fact that the Navy is saying these objects cannot be identified, they don't appear to be ours, we were able to track them, of course, with highly sophisticated technology, and that technology is the Raytheon company's AtFLIR systems, the Advanced Targeting Forward-Looking Infrared Pod. They were able to track these objects using that technology, and that itself does not mean that the objects could not be of earthly origin. It could be that these indeed belong to a foreign power. It could be that they belong to another branch of government, and that this technology, for whatever reason, is not something that the Navy has been made privy to, or there may be other reasons that they can't speak about that. But in their official statement, they've nonetheless said that, hey, we don't know what those objects are. That's our statement. I don't think that's ever been said before, and that should be incredibly significant to the UFO community, who, remarkably, seems to have overlooked this, along with most of the media. To me, that's a potential game changer, whatever the objects may be. Hey, I remain open-minded. I'm just cautious. More when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. I am Micah Hanks. Now, as I had mentioned earlier in the program, I had the pleasure, the distinct honor and privilege of heading down with a few of my cohorts to the town of Marion, North Carolina. Over the weekend, we went down and visited the, I think, second annual Bigfoot Festival that they now hold there in Marion. And it was a really fun time. It's obviously an event that is more geared toward families and consumerism. It's actually quite brilliant, in fact. I think somebody had proposed it last year. They just kind of threw it together, and there was a huge turnout, and they were like, whoa, we really need to broaden the scope of this. And so this year, they had a tremendous number of vendors. They closed down the entire main street. They had everyone from people selling T-shirts and art, crafts, jewelry, all these kind of things, to local research teams who claimed that they had actually been in the field and observed these things right here in North Carolina. And as I've said in the past, I have called myself a hopeful skeptic with regard to Bigfoot. I feel like I need to treat these subjects with a critical mind, with a certain degree of skepticism. I don't do that, though, for popularity. Again, with some of the feedback I get from listeners from time to time, some have actually written and said, you know, still like this show, but obviously you're going in a more mainstream direction with things. I get it. It must not have been super profitable for you in the past, just talking about UFOs and Sasquatch all the time. You'll probably reach a bigger audience if you are much more skeptical. Well, if anything, it's probably just the opposite. I don't do that to try and be popular or to impress anybody. I do it to be true to myself. I try to be as logical about these subjects as I can be. But I want to believe in Bigfoot. That's the truth. Bottom line, I want to believe that the creature's out there. I love Bigfoot, as Art Bell said. I wish he were my dad. But I mean, the truth is, as much as I wish that there were a Bigfoot, and perhaps maybe there is, I think there are some compelling arguments at times, we have to be really careful about just saying, well, I want to believe, therefore I think he's out there. What is the evidence? Does the evidence actually support the idea that there could be a creature, or are there other explanations for some of that evidence? So point in case, this is why I love going to these Bigfoot events, because you do get to meet people. Sometimes they'll have a table set up and they'll have some of their own castings. There was a lot of that down there. The folks from the Expedition Bigfoot Museum down in Georgia were there, and they had an impressive collection of castings, many of them provided by Cliff Barachman, who was actually there. He was not really speaking. He was kind of moderating a town hall where many of the locals and attendees actually shared their own stories about their experiences here and elsewhere. But talking with the folks from Expedition Bigfoot, for example, I asked them, I said, have you guys collected any of these tracks? And they said, no, these are the things that we keep in our museum. I said, have you ever seen one of the creatures? And the gentleman said, oh, yeah, on two occasions, both times in North Florida. And he was, you know, giving me a lot of personal reflections and thoughts about the subject. But at one point he said, and I often tell people these things don't want to be discovered. And if they bring us really good footage, I tell them, you know, keep that. And he turns them away. We don't want to display really good footage that proves that these creatures exist. And then he said, further, the more research you do, like I have done, the more you'll find that there is an element here at work that will not let this information come out. And I said, now, why is that? And he immediately responded. He kind of pointed at me and said, that, my friend, is for you to find out. But I think it's wonderful that we, of course, advocate people getting out there, children getting out and hiking, and that people can have adventures in their own backyard. They can go and they can find Bigfoot in their own backyard. And I'm thinking, that's remarkable. I wish I could go in my own backyard and find Bigfoot. I have studied this subject in depth for a couple of decades now, and I've never seen incontrovertible evidence that confirms their existence. But many people who operate in the field say, despite having looked for it for a long time like I have, that they have incontrovertible evidence given to them all the time. They say that they've had personal encounters, but that there are elements that keep it from becoming public knowledge. They can't say what, but they will remind you that that's what's going on, and that's why we don't have proof yet. Well, Jason and I stepped away from the table, and the gentleman began talking to another woman, and she asked some of the similar questions to those which I had raised, and he had exactly the same answers. It was pretty evident that this is sort of a spiel that he has given in the past, and who knows, maybe every one of his experiences are completely true and accurate. I would love to get down and see their museum. It's widely regarded as one of the best in the U.S. right now. That and actually a museum that Brackman has up in the Pacific Northwest. But it also seems a lot of the time to me like people who are proponents of this subject, they have some rather odd beliefs. And this is a pretty consistent feature. I see these things all the time. They come in my backyard. But there are reasons why. Science doesn't know that they exist. They don't want to be found. Again, I couldn't tell you if that's true or not. But it's not a really sound argument to me as to why there isn't better evidence for these creatures. But then we have some of the researchers who are there. There had been one gentleman, for instance, who had been in the news recently, and he had not only captured footage of something, which is the frustrating, reoccurring element in so many of these pieces of footage purporting to show Bigfoot. It shows something, but never distinct enough to rule out other possibilities, including hoaxing. But this gentleman appears in a news report having captured footage and having just managed to find footprints and made castings of them days before this event occurs. And I thought that's a little suspicious, right? You just happen to see Bigfoot right outside of town in the same town where there's going to be a big Sasquatch festival. Lo and behold, guess who's set up and has a table there? You guessed it, the same guy who I won't mention by name here. I want to be respectful. But I had the opportunity to go and meet the gentleman and talk to him for several minutes. Interestingly, the track casting that he had shown in the recent news report did not look impressive to me or the guys when we were there. I'd talked about it pretty extensively with Dakota and Jason and Jeff before we went down. And we weren't really impressed by the appearance of the casting. To me, it looked like it had probably been cut out using a skill saw or something like that. It had flat edges. As Jeff pointed out, it seemed to have 90-degree edges rather than being rounded and actually having contours. And when we got there, that footprint wasn't on display, and I asked him why, and he said it broke. He said it broke, and so I couldn't bring it. Okay. But he had plenty of others on display, and so I'm looking at some of these, and some of these casts are massive. I mean, they are 20 inches long or longer. And I said, so where do you find these? I said, do you ever go into the Linville Gorge? And he said, nope. He says, the Linville Gorge is too steep, and I'm too fat. I said, okay. I said, so where do you find these footprints? He says, I find them where I can go and I can look for them, which is right on the edge of town here. And I said, right on the edge of town here. Yes, sir. I said, so you find footprints 20 inches long right on the edge of town right here in Marion. You don't even have to go deep into the woods. You keep finding these things right here. And he said, yes, that's correct. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, again, you don't want to call somebody a liar, but for the footprint to be 20 inches long, how tall is this creature going to have to be? Is there only one of them? No. Presumably there would have to be a small pocket of them, maybe a breeding population. But again, if we're looking at a 20-inch footprint with a 6-foot stride, as he says, this is a really, really, really tall creature, a really tall animal, purportedly bipedal. And although Marion isn't a huge town, I mean, I have a little trouble seeing an area that is nonetheless as populated as that region as being home to a group of animals that, by virtue of the size of those footprints, would probably have to be in excess of 8, maybe 10 feet tall. It just strains credulity. There were other people who had their footprints on display, too. Some of them maybe were more credible than others, in fairness. But in addition to the research component that was there present at the event, then we also have the religious element. You know, Marion is a town in rural North Carolina, in the area known as the Bible Belt, and so you had a lot of the local churches with big signs, and they were using this extremely well-attended event to evangelize, which is fine, they can do that. They're standing there and they're handing out flyers and things along those lines, but what was really interesting was the diversity of attitudes towards Sasquatch by the religious presence, because some of the folks from the various churches who were evangelizing, they made no mention of Sasquatch, almost at times seemed kind of uncomfortable with it. That might have to do with some of their attitudes toward evolution and subjects along those lines. If anything, in light of that, we kind of speculated that they may have been somewhat averse to the idea of Sasquatch, and hence that's why they wanted their presence known. But some of the other churches also had very all-inclusive attitudes toward the subject. One actually read, it had like a silhouette of Sasquatch holding a little squirrel, and it read, "God loves all creatures, great and small." I thought that was kind of cute. But it was just interesting to see the diversity of opinions and beliefs and attitudes among the people who were there in attendance. I think probably the majority of people who were there probably couldn't care less if Sasquatch really exists. It's a fun thing for them to go and do with their family. And then I'm sure that there were some people there like myself who are intensely interested in this, and we see it both as an interesting cultural experience, but then again, I also hold out hope that there could be something physical and tangible to this. But yet again, while I want to believe, I have a hard time believing a lot of the evidence that I've seen presented in support of this subject. I think that there could be some that is more credible. And as Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum has said in the past, with all the footprints that have been found and castings that have been made, obviously a lot of those, maybe a majority, would have to be fakes. But all it takes is one real one. And if one of the footprint castings that has ever been made could actually be associated with a very large animal and something that looks an awful lot like us, at least the bottoms of its feet do, that's definitely something that's interesting. All we need is one. The one real one is the game changer. Now, I want to go to the audio sound bites because somebody else who's had Bigfoot on his mind recently was Joe Rogan. Podcaster and comedian Joe Rogan had Dan Aykroyd on his podcast recently. I'm sure a lot of you guys probably saw this by now. And in addition to talking about UFOs and all kinds of cover-ups and things, it's pretty evident that Dan is all in on all this stuff. I mean, whether it's Mothman, whether it's UFO cover-ups, Dan Aykroyd, he's obviously well-read on the subject, but it's obvious to me also that he's made up his mind and he really believes all of it. And at one point, Sasquatch comes up. And Joe Rogan, I thought at first, was being kind of critical of the subject, but as it turns out, he actually is saying, of all these subjects we're talking about, he says, that's the weird one to me because I want to believe in that one. But Joe seems to basically be of the same mind that I am. I was actually kind of impressed. He knows a lot about the subject, obviously. He knows a lot about the history of the subject. He doesn't commit to belief, but he says, that's the one that's still weird to me, and I can't say that that one's not real. Let's go to the audio soundbites. In this first one, Joe Rogan gives an explanation for his interest in the Bigfoot subject.
Bigfoot is interesting to me because there was a creature called Gigantopithecus. It was an enormous primate that was without a doubt lived. It's a real thing. It was a bipedal hominid. They think it was between 8 and perhaps even 10 feet tall. It was a huge ape-like creature, and it went extinct. And the reason why they found it is because there was an apothecary shop. I believe it was in the 1920s. An anthropologist found a tooth in this apothecary shop in China. He talked to the people, where'd you find this? He recognized it as a primate tooth. They brought him to the site where they found it, and then they started finding other pieces. They found bones that that seemed to indicate that this thing was bipedal. And this is something that's accepted in the paleontological record. This is like when anthropologists look at the history of primates, when they look at they think this is a widely accepted real animal. So
why wouldn't it
was real?
Why do you say that it couldn't have survived and beyond extinction and exists today in some form.
There's no evidence that's compelling. Just like there's
the
no
film
evidence
is fake.
That
they think they,
woolly mammoth.
Pretty much the film is fake.
The Patterson footage.
Say it's fake.
Here's the thing: if it looks like a man in a suit, no animal looks like a man in a suit.
Now that was really bizarre, that portion of the conversation to me, because again, we did the whole episode about the Patterson film. Yet again, I got a little pushback for doing that show, not because people were saying, oh, come on, Micah, you sound like you believe in that footage. No, quite the contrary. Many people had said, you didn't go deep enough. You left this out. You left that out. Guys, you got to remember, this show is featured as a 2-hour radio program every Monday night on KGRARadio.com. Unfortunately, there are distinct limitations in terms of the amount of time I can spend on this main podcast. Don't forget, there are the subscriber shows. One of the reasons we do a subscriber show in the first place, when we launched the X podcasts, that was so that the spillover would happen. We would have more time to address these subjects. But on the primary podcast, there is that time limitation. And so on the main podcast, I'm limited in terms of how much I can discuss these things. And yet we still had a really lengthy discussion about the Patterson-Gimlin film. Just not as lengthy as the several episodes my brothers over there, Scott and Forrest, did at Astonishing Legends. And I highly recommend that. They did such a good job with that series of episodes. But yet again, they did that. Scott and Forrest went really deep on the PG film. And if I had done the exact same thing on this podcast, imagine how redundant that would be. Which is why we did an episode about it. But we focused on the latest 4K renderings of the film. And Lauren gives us perspectives on that with a background, actually, with a college degree and having worked in the industry for more than a decade as a professional video editor with an outdoor entertainment company. She gives us her perspectives on this and some of the technology that we're looking at, why it's significant. In other words, we talked about things that weren't addressed on the Astonishing Legends show without doing the exact same several series of shows. They already did that. They did a fantastic job, and it's one of the reasons I really like those guys. But certainly, if they've already done that, why would we do it again? Take that as part of the argument that's been built around that very controversial film, which in my opinion, and this was the point that we drove home on that episode, this is, I think, the most important thing about the PG film. It has not yet proven to be authentic, but it has not yet been completely disproven. And as we outlined on that episode, many of the skeptical arguments against it to me are very unconvincing. And I think that they are as, if not more, unconvincing than some of the evidence in support of the film, particularly by virtue of the fact that the man who says that he sold the costume to Patterson could not seem to reconcile what's in the film with the costume he made. He said, that's definitely my costume. But he looks like he's added breasts. The face mask that he made isn't mine. Looks like the arms were extended. Looks pretty different. But it's definitely mine. That's definitely the suit I sold him. And then Bob Hieronymus, the guy who wore the suit, he's saying, well, it was made out of horse hide. But then when he finds out that Philip Morris claims that he made the suit, then Bob Hieronymus says, oh, you know what? Yeah, that was the suit that I wore. It wasn't made out of horse hide after all. It was the suit that he wore. And then skeptics, again, Joe Nickel, who I really, really respect. But Joe Nickel says, he says, after thinking about it, trying to remember what happened 30 years ago, that in hindsight, after further reflection, yeah, it actually was the suit that Morris sold him, not the horsehide suit. Again, I really have a problem with really good skeptics who are all too willing to accept at face value remarkably contradictory arguments that have been raised about those who claimed to have been assisting in that hoax. And if we're really going to be skeptics, we don't just get to be skeptical of the things we don't agree with. We have to apply our skepticism at all times, fairly and equally. And this is why Tim McMillan and I, on the phone the other day, were talking about this. And Tim said, you know, Micah, here's the bottom line. He says, I don't think we can really call ourselves skeptics, not by the modern definition of that term. We are investigative researchers. We write, we do podcasts, we study, but we don't have biases. We are not out to disprove. And we are not more inclined to believe or disbelieve things based on our attitudes toward that subject, as many modern skeptics do. And so if I sound like I'm still an advocate for the Patterson-Gimlin film, that would be the reason why. I'm unconvinced, like I am by much of the evidence in support of Sasquatch. I'm very unconvinced by the skeptical arguments against that film. And because of that, while I don't think that video will ever prove the existence of Sasquatch, I don't think that it has officially completely been debunked either. which is why it's really weird that Dan Aykroyd, someone who seems to kind of be all in on all this stuff, he's sitting there talking with Joe Rogan saying, oh yeah, that video was proven to be a hoax. I'm thinking, what? You know, that's the one piece of evidence that many people who are on the fence about this subject still look at that video and go, you know, that's the one I just can't get around. But anyway, coming back to the audio soundbites, the next thing that they talk about is the possible existence, the persistence of the giant sloth in parts of South America.
Try finding a wolverine.
Yeah. You
know, try finding
one of these super sloths in the South American jungle now, these big sloths.
They're real. There's one scientist that has literally risked his reputation and his whole credibility is in demise because he decided that he was going to spend his life looking for the giant sloth. Mm-hmm. And these indigenous people have pointed him in the right direction and they've recognized that there's dung that seems to be sloth mm-hmm. dung that they've found, and they're trying to point him towards where these things are. And the giant sloth was a real creature. But there's no real evidence that the giant sloth is currently alive. But the thing is, the vast wilderness of the Amazon rainforest is so impenetrable. It would be like trying to walk across the earth and make a good audit of all the creatures that are on it. You're not going to run into them.
I wanted to feature that audio soundbite because in the broader discussion of cryptozoology and Bigfoot, I like the fact that Joe is obviously really well read on the subject. He and Dan Aykroyd both are. And although I think that Joe is more critically minded than Dan is, I think it was a really good conversation that they were having. And of course, you know, I appreciate Dan's interest in all this stuff just as much as anybody else. I'm happy to agree to disagree with someone, although I think Dan believes a whole lot more of this stuff than I do. Joe, I was really impressed by the fact that he's bringing up giant sloths, Gigantopithecus, and in this next audio soundbite, he goes on to say, as you'll hear, that nobody wants to believe in Bigfoot more than Joe Rogan.
Many species are dying on this planet right now for various reasons, but there are many that are being discovered we never even knew about before. And you know, the northwestern forests are pretty impenetrable too. The Washington forests.
That's what makes it interesting, is that the location of the area where if the thing crossed the Bering Land Bridge and it came into the United States, mm-hmm. that's exactly where it would be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be in that Pacific Northwest because that's, you know, as you walk down from Alaska through
Canada. We've heard the stories of loggers going in there and seeing them or sensing them or, mm-hmm. you know, because they're being driven out of their environment. There's some hostile acts against logging companies that they think have been perpetrated by the Sasquatch. Yeah.
Nobody wants to believe in Bigfoot more than me.
I don't know, Mr. Rogan. I might be right there with you. I might actually want to believe in Bigfoot as much as, if not more, than you. But I appreciate his critically minded approach because that's something I absolutely share. And so if it ever comes across on this show like I'm being too dismissive of subjects like that, the reason is not because I don't want to believe. The reason is because if we treat evidence critically and it actually withstands scrutiny, it actually makes a stronger case in support of the phenomena we're studying. And maybe with time, maybe with some patience, we will continue to find further evidence that, unlike the footage, unlike the footprint castings, and unlike the hair samples currently on record, maybe eventually we will finally find that proof that irrefutably makes the case for the existence of creatures like Sasquatch, whether here in North America and or in other parts of the world. It still fascinates me. All right, more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. I am Micah Hanks. Getting into the second hour of this week's edition of the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be here with you, being your guide as we go explore all the mysteries, the great enigmas of our existence. You know, speaking of those enigmas, we dropped the new episode of Enigmas for the ex-subscribers over the weekend. Really interesting discussion we had on this episode about Easter Island. and the undeciphered possible language that is depicted on some of the Rongo Rongo tablets. And so that's something for subscribers to enjoy, as well as the weekly additional edition known as the X Podcast. Keep in mind, if you would like to subscribe, if you aren't already a subscriber, just head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast and click subscribe to X in the top right-hand corner of the page. Or longtime legacy listeners know they can head over to GraylianReport.com/X. And keep in mind, we've still got a lot of excellent content going up on the Graylian Report, our little home on the web, the official home of this program, and of course many of my other endeavors as well. But we had that write-up that I really encourage everybody to read about John Greenwald's reporting and the statement he was given by the Pentagon about this. In fact, he just messaged me thanking me for the article, because it's such important work to me that people like John Greenwald are doing. And in this era where we seem to be always so skeptical of these subjects, or we are all in on belief and completely uncritically minded, we need more than ever good researchers who does like John Greenwald does, and like I try to do, who look at these subjects and say, we want to get to the bottom of this. We don't want to rule anything out of hand, but let's be cautious. Let's ask some hard questions. John's been doing that lately, and I got to say, he catches so much flack from the UFO community. Oh, you're just a doubter. You're just a disbeliever, John. That guy's arguably done more for UFO research in the last couple of decades, keeping in mind he started the Black Vault when he was in his teens. That guy very well may likely have done more for UFO research than anybody else. And I got to say, I've got a lot of friends in the community, many of whom I respect, who have even been among those who attacked John. But I'm really disheartened when I'm seeing people like John's name being removed from former awards that he was given simply because of the fact that he asks hard questions and that he has challenged perspectives that, honestly, I think a lot of people in the UFO community who are less critically minded simply will not address. They want to overlook those things. But most importantly, I really want people to be willing to hear each other out, to get along, to be able to share in dialogue and discourse. UFO community at large, please hear me when I say this. Again, we focus so much on the current schisms in relation to all of this. We look so little at the actual research. We should be praising people, in my opinion, like John Greenwald right now, people who are asking hard questions and who continue to provide greater transparency on issues and government pertaining to this, and in a serious and critically minded way. So good on you, John. We appreciate your work. Again, I got to get him on this show sometime soon. He's a busy guy. He's a family man, too. I always appreciate that. I also appreciate hearing from you guys, and we've got a few listener emails we really need to get caught up on. First up, Jesse had written to me a while back, and I've referenced this already on a couple of the podcasts, but I want to mention Jesse's email here on the heels of our discussion about Bigfoot and cryptozoology in the last segment, because he wrote and he said, I thought it would be fun to share this story. Last year, a friend and I were visiting Miami, helping my family move out to Seattle. Now, I grew up in Miami for 20 years, and I'm very familiar with the normal Florida sea creatures, and this was out of my wheelhouse. During some downtime, we decided to go fishing off of Old Cutler and 57th. We walked about 3/4 of a mile down the path to fish around the mouth of the canal, which empties into a bay and into the ocean there. A ski boat, Jesse says, was coming out of the marina, and about 100 yards behind the boat, playing in the wake, was an extremely large something. He says, I have no clue what it was. My best guess would be a very large seal-type animal, but no seals live in Miami that I know of. It was moving quite quick. It for sure wasn't a manatee, as it was about 9 to 12 feet long, but not nearly as big in the midsection as a manatee, and it was very agile. It porpoised up and down, like head out of the water, then the body. My buddy who was with me was a commercial fisherman, and we both were shocked. We watched it swim from far away, then right by us and out into the ocean, and this all lasted about 45 seconds to a minute. I have no clue what it could have been, and have never seen anything like it. Pretty crazy. Thought I would share. And again, we've touched on that. I've mentioned it in various interviews and podcasts and things, but I wanted to share that complete email here from Jesse just because it sounds an awful lot to me like what he's describing is exactly what he says he saw. He said it looked like a very large something. I would compare it to a seal. Well, there had been very large seals at one time in the Caribbean and all the way up to Florida and the Panhandle area, and these were known as the Caribbean monk seal. But the problem is that the last ones known to have existed in the wild or in captivity haven't been seen since maybe the 1960s. It sounds an awful lot like what Jesse is describing. There is a known animal species believed to be extinct. And this kind of thing happens so often. Before we get into a little of the space news happening right now in advance of our discussion with Dr. Brian Keating, I've got to share a quick story on the heels of Jesse's email there. When we get back from the festival yesterday, I come in and I shower and I kind of get ready to go back out and grab a bite to eat, because you never feel like cooking after you've been on the road all day and doing this. So I go to a little local pizza place that has delicious wood fire pizzas, and I'm sitting there at the bar placing a to-go order and just having a brew, and there's one other guy at the bar with me, and he's obviously getting a big takeout order for his family. And Grace, the bartender, and I are talking, and she's kind of laughing and saying, "Where have you been today?" And when I explain, we're kind of joking about, "Oh, he's a believer," and all of this. And I said, "Well, of course, that's a whole nother conversation." But the gentleman sitting next to me, he says, "You know, I'm an outdoorsman, actually, and although I have never seen that guy," he says, "I'll tell you what I have seen right up here on the mountain," which, of course, is right here in my community. He says, "On two occasions now, I have seen what I can only call large black cats. They look like cougars or mountain lions, but they're black." And I said, "Oh, do tell." And he describes two instances, once in 2006, where he saw a mother and two cubs run right down through the yard of their property, he and his family at that time. They moved away for a few years, and then he said, "We wanted to get back to the family property that my dad had owned, and so we moved back over into this area." And he said, "In early 2018, my son came in one day and said, 'Dad, I think there's a bear outside.'" And so he said, "Well, I stepped outside and I looked and I saw clearly that what he was seeing was black, but it was no bear." He says, "It was one of these large black cats." And he said, "So I went back inside. I got my hunting rifle." My wife is like, "Don't shoot it. My gosh, they're endangered." He said, "I'm not going to shoot it. I want to look at it through the scope." And he does. He looks through the scope and he said, "I could see it very clearly. It's only about 100 yards away," but he said through the scope, he's able to get a really clear look at this thing. And he said there was something unusual about its fur. He said it looked almost like it was mangy, like it might not be really healthy. And it sat there for a few minutes and then took off. But he said it was a fairly lengthy sighting. I was able to see it for quite a while. But having seen him once already, he said, "I mean, it is no question in my mind." And he says, "Further, I have actually seen the eastern cougars around here also. Those believed to be extinct since 2018, when they were officially designated as such." He said, "I do contracting and real estate, and the gentleman told me there was a job site we went to on an adjacent mountain right here in the community, and the folks had said, 'We've been hearing a large cat up there recently, and just be careful if you go up on that property.'" And he told me, "Even in light of my own personal experiences, I kind of took that with a grain of salt and go walking up through the woods, and sure enough," he says, "on the ridge just above me, I see a head pop up," and he says, "It's quite evidently a cougar." And he says the thing stands up and walks along the ridge and then goes off down the other side, and he can't see it anymore. But he said there it was, right there in broad daylight. And all of those sightings of big cats he has seen, not at dusk, not at night, he said they were in broad daylight. And I even have a friend up the road here who got a picture of one on a game cam. And so then he brings out his phone and says, "I'm going to try and find that picture." And he couldn't find it on his phone. So I passed him my card and I said, "Look, if you come across that picture, please email that to me." And the same goes for all you guys out there. I am really interested in hearing people's firsthand accounts. I love to feature those stories on the show. I love to feature listeners' emails. Probably some of the most prolific we've ever shared are those of my brother James down the mountain, who has shared so many great stories that we've featured on the program. But again, I'd like to talk to this gentleman here in my locale. Again, we exchanged information, but he's not even the only person who has shared this kind of story with me. A few years ago, my former neighbor who lived right next door, he knew my interest in all this stuff. And he said, "Look, I got to tell you, I have seen a black panther up there on a mountain outside of town here." And I said, "What?" And he had said the same thing. He said a lot of the locals have seen these cats up there. And sadly, when the man I was talking with at the bar contacted DNR and reported this animal sighting, they said, "Sir, those don't exist." And that seems to remain the official stance on this subject. If people claim that they have seen these animals, first of all, the eastern cougar are extinct. And interestingly, on one website that Lauren provided me a link to, it actually explains that U.S. Fish and Wildlife and other agencies, the U.S. Forestry Service, acknowledge that sightings still occur, but they say that these are wide-ranging animals, and that if a sighting of a cougar occurs, that doesn't mean that there is still a breeding population, that the animals are still believed to be extinct. But I'm like, okay, so are you saying that if one of these things is seen in North Carolina, or one of these things is seen somewhere, you know, in New Hampshire, Are we to believe that a Western cougar, a lone Western cougar, has crossed the United States, and that when someone has seen one of these things, that explains it, that there are still none of them on the eastern coast? I just don't know if I buy that. Again, here seems to be an instance where we have a known species believed to be extinct, but plenty of people still see them. Plenty of people still appear to be seeing also a different variety. And here's the problem. The idea of the black cat is problematic because the eastern cougar, for it to be black, it would have to be a variety of melanism, as I understand it. And actually, more likely what people are seeing, if they are seeing some sort of a black cat, would be a jaguar, many of which actually do have that melanistic property. But if the light hits them the right way, the melanistic jaguars, you're actually able to see their spotted patterns. And that brought to mind what the gentleman at the bar had told me. He said, you know, looking through the scope, there was something about its fur. It almost looked kind of mangy. I'd wondered if he hadn't actually been describing the typical markings you would expect to see on a black or a melanistic jaguar. I'd wondered about that because most wildlife experts would correctly point out that you're not going to be very likely to see something like a jaguar in most of North America. Those animals range throughout South America and the jungle environments there, and on up into the extreme southern portions of North America, mostly just Mexico. But you aren't going to see that in the mountains of North Carolina. Now, before we would rule that out, we also have to keep in mind that there are plenty of other animal species that, due to things like climate changes, have been migrating further and further north. I mean, recently we have even seen armadillo right here in East Asheville and other parts of North Carolina. Years ago, that would have been unheard of. Those animals had ranged probably no further north than parts of Georgia, maybe the extreme southern portions of South Carolina. And now we're seeing them in North Carolina. As the habitat and the climate changes, many of these animals are ranging to different areas. And of course, on that note of these being wide-ranging animals, some of these lone cats of the large variety, maybe it isn't impossible that an animal that is typically known to be relegated to the southern extremities might from time to time make their way further north. I wouldn't rule out any possibility. But I think that the problem seems to be that many people do rule out those possibilities, and when time after time people are saying, look, I saw something, it looked like a cougar or some other large cat, but it was black, rather than saying, okay, could this have been an adaptation? Keeping in mind, too, that the melanism tends to be, in many instances, what appears to be a genetic change that occurs in a fairly short amount of time and often as a result of pressures in the environment. This seems to be something that may help these animals survive. So if we are looking at a critically endangered species, it might make all the more sense why, in some instances, we see pockets of them that begin to appear with this melanism. It's an interesting story. And from time to time, you get those stories where people describe either animals that are out of place and shouldn't be seen where they are seen, animals that are believed to be extinct but which people are still seeing, and then, yes, of course, the most compelling of all, the reports of animals that should not exist at all but which people continue to claim to see. Those are probably the neatest of all and perhaps also the most speculative. I've got one more email I want to touch on here briefly before we get into a little space news in advance of talking with Dr. Brian Keating. And JM writes to me and says, hey, Micah, first things first, love the new show. It's refreshing, and I'm so excited for you. And secondly, on the matters of alien life, that was a very interesting conversation that you had with Laird. I could have listened to his thoughts and ideas for longer than a couple of hours, but they are so deep and mind-bending sometimes. Lastly, she said, I'm sure you already know that it's Suicide Prevention Month. And I know that it's not covered in the scope of your programming, but maybe considering the current status of the world, you could mention something about it. And she goes on to relate a story about a young niece of hers who had been having a bad day and had said something along the lines of, I don't want to be alive anymore. And it really, she said, broke her heart and asked if it wouldn't be something we could touch on. And I say absolutely. Again, this is one of the things that I hope to do with this show, to try and broaden some of the subject matter we discuss. And in fact, there was a recent fairly high-profile suicide reported by the New York Times in the field of the sciences, and so in addition to some SETI discussion later on the show here when we get Dr. Brian Keating on, I want to ask him about that. He's going to give us his own perspectives about this and actually how the Nobel Prize may have played a role in that. But before we get Brian on, and thanks to all of you who have written in with your stories this week, info@MicahHanks.com. I would love to hear from you if you've got a story you'd like to share. But astronomers have made a really big announcement in the last few days. And although this may not be evidence of alien life, per se, This does, of course, involve an interstellar object passing through the solar system. The second one that we have detected, and this, of course, on the heels of the famous Oumuamua, and Universe Today reported on this. They said after multiple surveys were conducted, of course, scientists were left scratching their heads as to what the aforementioned object back in 2017, Oumuamua, actually was, with speculation ranging from it being a comet or an asteroid to a comet fragment or even, yes, an extraterrestrial solar sail. Well, they said one of the greatest takeaways from that event was the discovery that such objects pass through our solar system on a fairly regular basis, and some of them actually stay. And as it turns out, astronomers with NASA, the ESA, and the International Scientific Optical Network recently announced the discovery of what may indeed be a second interstellar object. Some are already referring to it as Oumuamua 2.0. Now, this new object has been designated C2019Q4 Borisov in honor of Gennady Borisov, an astronomer with the Crimean Astrophysical Observatory who first detected the object back on August 30th. NASA's Scout system, which monitors newly discovered asteroids and comets as part of the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies, indicated that it had an unusual orbit shortly thereafter. Well, a few days later, astronomer Marco Micheli from the ESA's Near-Earth Object Coordination Center managed to obtain images of the object through ISON. Micheli, who is credited with the discovery of multiple NEOs, or near-Earth objects, also conducted several measurements of the object's position using data provided by the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope in Mauna Kea, Hawaii. Well, right now the ESA is analyzing all of the available data. We don't know exactly what it is, but one statement that Micheli provided was that we are, quote, now working on getting more observations of this unusual object. We need to wait a few days to really pin down its origin with observations that will either prove the current thesis that it is interstellar or perhaps drastically change our understanding. Now, that is indeed extremely exciting news, and I'm sure we'll have more updates to follow. Who knows what these interstellar objects might be. But when it comes to the discussion of interstellar objects, one of my favorite topics is astronomy, and so I love to talk with astronomers. And Brian Keating is someone who many of our listeners will already be familiar with. He has joined us on the program in the past. He is Distinguished Professor of Physics at the Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences in the Department of Physics at University of California, San Diego. And his book, Losing the Nobel Prize, which has become a personal favorite of mine, was selected as one of the best science books of the year at Science Friday, Amazon, Science News, Physics Today, Forbes, and Symmetry Magazine. Obviously, a lot of other people liked it, too. So I figured it was about time we get him back on. Dr. Keating, how are you doing?
It's great. It's a wonderful day, and it's always lovely to be with you, Mika. We've had a lot of positive reaction, a little negative reaction, but the negative reaction, you know, if you don't get negative reaction, it means you're not doing your job right. If people don't disagree with you, then what you're saying is a little probably too bland and not effectual. So I've gotten some criticism, but that was to be expected, primarily from people that either love the Nobel Prize and think it's great, or people that are actually working for the Nobel Prize or hope to win it themselves. So The main people that I want to reach, which are young people, students, young scientists, have been overwhelmingly supportive. And I gave a talk up at the Bay Area last week for the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is a passion of mine as well. And there's a young girl came up to me and she asked me, you know, if I could sign this drawing that she made of me in my book. And it was probably 12 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Just so touching to me. She had a NASA shirt on, and she wants to be a scientist, and that I have influence over young people and hopefully guiding them in the direction of passion for science and technology is just a great blessing and fortune that I'm able to have.
Indeed, that really is something I appreciate about your work, Brian. And in addition to your advocacy as a scientist, in addition to your work as an educator, we do share that interest in SETI, and I did want to get into that subject with you a little bit, talk some about the SETI program. Many scientists, in fact, are looking at the discovery of extraterrestrial life as being an imminent discovery. They say that within just a few years, this is going to be a reality. It's going to step out of the realm of speculation and science fiction and into the real world. So I'd love to get your perspectives on this. How close are we to discovering alien life, and what is the state of the art with the science pertaining to that?
So SETI, I should say, for listeners who might not be as familiar and passionate as I am and you are, but it's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So it's not merely the search for life. And actually, I make it even more of a distinction because I say it's a search for technology, because the only way we would really get evidence for you know, intelligent life is if we have evidence for technology. And so, for example, if there was a dolphin swimming around in an ocean on you know, the moon Titan, we would never know about it unless the dolphins have created some, you know, brand new iPhone 11 or something like that. whatever dolphins use to communicate, it certainly doesn't seem to be technologically. And so we would be blind to that. Now, that doesn't mean life doesn't exist, but I think we'd all agree it's much more exciting to find a dolphin than to find a microbe, although both would be revolutionarily exciting and a step forward for the human species to understand we may not be the only species on this entire universe, and certainly within our galaxy. And so the search for it has gone on for 50 or 60 years, and actually the SETI Institute is really the byproduct of two great scientists. One is Jill Tarter, who was the inspiration for the character played by Jodie Foster in Carl Sagan's movie called Contact. She's a real-life person, and she and Frank Drake, who's a famous scientist who came up with this calculation that could be used to set the a limit or a number of extraterrestrial intelligent species that may exist in the universe. And so they've been going at this for 50 years now, over 50 years, hoping, you know, to find ways technologically to perceive the existence of an advanced life form in some other part of our galaxy. We know it probably can't be in our solar system. The conditions don't seem to be right anywhere else but Earth for intelligent life. But actually, the search has expanded, as you asked, about technology that enables it. We now believe that there's actually an interesting progression. So the movie Contact, your listeners might remember, starts off with like radio transmissions from the 1932 Olympics, I think it is, broadcasting out into space. And then, so that was like the first mass broadcast television signal on Earth. And that's great. And it went out, and now it's been, you know, 70, you know, 87 years or whatever since that broadcast. But at the same time, you have, you know, this notion that the way that our civilization has progressed, now we transmit almost nothing via these antennas, right? So you have almost everything via beamed, you know, fiber optics or cable TV, you know, for television. Very little is, you know, broadcast directly out into space. And so if other civilizations took the same route, you might not expect them to be seeable, because the period of time in which they use the technology might have only been 50 years. And if you're not looking in the right 50-year bracket, you're not going to see them.
Yeah.
And so then the question has come up, well, what other forms of life could be detectable? What planets have meeting possible criteria? We know there's thousands and thousands. There might be a trillion planets in our own galaxy alone, and there might be, you know, half a trillion galaxies in the observable universe. So I think there's a lot of research going into this to see, well, how would an alien communicate with us? And maybe it would be as envisioned in Contact, or maybe it would be something radically different. And so the best approach is to use our most sensitive detectors and telescopes in a targeted fashion to look at the most promising potential planets that might host life.
Right. You know, another fascinating thing that's happening right now is the idea that we have enough technology that even if the alien life in question, the alien intelligence, even if they were not trying to communicate directly with us or search for other life, that we might still detect their techno signatures. The concept of, for instance, a Dyson sphere comes to mind here. So is it equally probable in your mind that we might detect alien life that is utilizing advanced technology, but not necessarily beaming that into the cosmos?
Yeah, there's a fellow author at the same publisher that I wrote Losing the Nobel Prize with, Norton. His name is Adam Frank. He's a professor in New York, upstate New York. He has a book called Light of the Stars, in which he argues that the, you know, most promising signature to look for is not necessarily, you know, a beam of or any radio waves or high energy photons or what have you, but instead just might be to look for the effects of, you guessed it, greenhouse gases. So warming trend established on Earth, he claims, you know, predominantly by not sources such as radio waves or television broadcasts, but actually from farming, the advent of farming perhaps 10,000 years ago, the advent of mass amounts of animals used for livestock, and then that contribution towards climate change. And then simply the evolution of a biosphere over time that might increase the probability for detection, and the biosignatures that would be present would be much more easily detected, perhaps, than the actual radio transmission, because you're looking at a planetary-wide distribution of energy in the case of a climate change signal. So surprisingly, after that calculation, he comes up with a calculation that really can put a constraint on how many civilizations capable of producing global warming, climate change, planetary evolution could have existed in the entire history of the observable universe. And he comes up with a number that on the small end is like 100 such advanced civilizations. That sounds, you know, decent. If there were, you know, 100 civilizations in our solar system, you know, we would not never have asked the question, are we alone? We would know it as a fact. But 100 over the 14 billion year lifetime of the universe, if they're evenly distributed or somehow plausibly distributed, I mean, hundreds of millions of years between civilizations. And it would mean that they're distributed perhaps 50 to almost 100 billion light years away from us, meaning that we could never even have causally connected with them and contacted with them and observed signals from them and transmitted signals to them. So it's quite improbable from that calculation, although he claims that's a big number. I think it's a very small number. And so the odds, you know, in my opinion, about detecting this within our lifetime has to be expressed as a very small number. And even Seth Shostak, who's the foremost, he's the chief astronomer at SETI Institute, famous author and podcaster, et cetera. He doesn't even seem to be, you know, he always says that this is, you know, it could happen next year, it could happen 1,000 years from now, it could never happen. So I think, you know, we can't really put a probability on it, but we're learning a lot more about the conditions necessary for life. And seeing that they're pretty common throughout the universe that we can observe, that doesn't necessarily prove that life exists, but it certainly proves life is could exist.
Absolutely. And it seems the more we learn about ourselves, the more likely we are to be able to detect similar things by biological intelligent life forms on other planets. We're talking with Brian Keating, and he is the author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize. And especially in light of one of the listener emails that I received this week, I do want to talk with Brian about a recent story we saw in the news and how this has pertinence to some of his own writing and work. We will continue this conversation with Dr. Brian Keating right here on the Micah Hanks program when we return right after this. From the high mountains of Appalachia and sending our dispatches out across the heartland, all across the globe, welcome back. I am Micah Hanks. We're talking with Dr. Brian Keating, a friend of the program. He's the author of the book Losing the Nobel Prize. We've had him on in the past, but in light of some of the news pertaining to interstellar discoveries, I wanted to get him on to talk about SETI a bit, as well as his broader work. And that brings us to the subject that we're about to touch on with him right now. And, you know, one of the things I think that we have to understand about ourselves is the ways that our culture and our society affect our mentality and the things that drive us. Again, this is fundamental to what you talk about in Losing the Nobel Prize, Brian. And, you know, you had sent me this story the other day. It's a tragic story, in fact. It involves Martin Wiseman, who had been a climate economist. And the New York Times reporting his apparent suicide, I was shocked when I read the story. And they had noted the fact that after having not won the Nobel Prize himself, that his attitude and his mood had seemed to take a marked turn. And it's such tragic news. And you'd reached out to me and had said, you know, I never want to see this kind of thing happen again. Can we talk a bit about that? Maybe the impact that story had on you. And of course, with relation to the book you've written about this very subject and some of the negative side of what is arguably perceived as being the best prize that a scientist can achieve.
Yeah, so you have, you know, very frequent examples of people that, say, lose money or lose fame or don't win certain accolades throughout the spheres of entertainment or in politics, that suffer from depression and sometimes escalate all the way to, you know, actual suicide. And in this case, this poor man was despondent, and many, according to many accounts in that report, in part due to his failure to win the Nobel Prize. And then, as I pointed out in the book, you know, they don't give it again for the same discovery or the same field, etc. But I just wish desperately I could have met this man and told him and given him a copy of my book to show how ludicrous the aspiration to win the Nobel Prize is. It's kind of like saying, you know, would you have liked to win the, you know, would you kill yourself over not winning the Longitude Prize? And you're like, right. What's the Longitude Prize? That was like 400 years ago, 300 years ago. Nobody even cares about it. And the likelihood of people caring about the Nobel Prize in a few decades, perhaps longer, if they continue with some of the negative trends they've had, you know, sex abuse scandals that have rocked the Nobel Prize. And I talk about some of it in my book, the other scandals involving, you know, dictators and really mass murderers and people accused of horrible things, winning the Nobel Peace Prize, arguably the most prestigious prize that is offered. You know, you don't hear about so many of these aspects in physics. In chemistry, a Nobel Prize is won by, you know, the person generally considered to be the father of chemical warfare or chemical weapons. And so you see this throughout all these prizes, and then to have a person, you know, venerate this prize to such an exalted level that upon not winning it, he, you know, he feels depressed. And maybe that did cause him to commit suicide. I don't know why they would keep mentioning if it didn't. And it's tragedy upon a tragedy, because it really is showing the level to which the Nobel Prize is taken so seriously and so sacrosanct that it's almost, in my opinion, as I describe in the book, it's become a religion. And it's a religion that's worshipped by people who have prized, you know, these accolades and awards above almost anything else. And I feel truly in my heart, if I had an hour with this gentleman, at least with regard, I can't speak for the other aspects of pain and mental suffering and anguish he must have been afflicted with. But if I had an hour, if I could just talk to this poor, poor man, I could have had an impact, I hope, to make him feel that, at least in this aspect, again, I can't address the other mental, I'm not a psychologist, sure. Psychiatrist, but to make him realize that this award is really, in a lot of ways, a naked emperor that people are truly bowing down to and worshiping. And again, it's set by a few hundred academicians in Sweden that determine this prize. And even the economics prize that he aspired to, apparently, it was only a recent invention, and it was construed as being an abomination, essentially, towards the Nobel name by one of Nobel's grandnephews, who basically had petitioned them to remove Alfred Nobel's name from the prize. So it's no longer called the Nobel Prize in Economics. It was never created by Alfred Nobel. He knew nothing about it. And so it's now known as the Swedish Central Bank Prize in memory of Alfred Nobel. And you know, when you think about it like that, like, would you be depressed, say, over not winning the, you know, the Kansas, you know, Federal Bank Reserve Prize for, you know, whatever podcasting? Yeah, I cannot imagine it. And to exalt this so high, it really depressed me a little bit too. And I feel this is such a great tragedy, and I just wish that it could never happen again.
I appreciate, again, you bringing it to my attention, because I've had many friends. I think we all have friends in our lives, Brian, or even, you know, we as individuals from time to time, we may, you know, battle depression or stigmas because of certain subjects we have interest in. For instance, again, the search for extraterrestrial life. That's a very loaded one, because while I believe that in likelihood extraterrestrial life does exist somewhere, or at very least at some point has existed, and that life or evidence of it, maybe in the past even, could be detectable, that is a subject that, when you get into the, again, the more controversial revelations by the U.S. Navy and their study of unexplained aerial phenomena, they get rather polarized on those. So to try and be a scientific educator or a proponent of science education, and then also to be willing to push boundaries, it can become at times difficult, because you're inevitably going to be attacked. And really, after reading your book, it helped me, and I want to thank you for that, it helped me kind of see yet again that even though the Nobel Prizes are not explicitly only awarded for science achievements, the fact that this has become the be-all, end-all for so many, and yes, as you correctly say, the New York Times article references that in relation to a number of factors which may have contributed to this man's decision to commit suicide. I couldn't imagine a greater tragedy when we really break this down and go, what do these goals that people strive for, what do these awards really mean? And as you have pointed out, the most important takeaway for me about your book is that how does that influence scientists specifically in terms of the goals that they aim for and the kinds of studies that they try to achieve? It could actually be a hindrance, couldn't it?
I think it definitely is. And, you know, I bring up several instances in my book, including this famous study called Goldman's Dilemma, where there was a question posed to the most elite athletes in the world, Olympic caliber athletes, by a physician named Robert Goldman. And Goldman asked these athletes if they would take a drug that would guarantee them, you know, say winning an Olympic gold medal or winning overwhelmingly victorious in their sporting endeavors, but they would also then die 5 years later. And he reported originally that there were at least half of the people that responded would take that drug, would take that risk, that take that certainty rather, that they would die in exchange for this accolade, glory, and success. I think it's it just shows you that in humanity there is this obsession with prizes, with honors, with awards, with glory. And I really, again, trace it to almost a form of religion where you have a worshipful attitude. You have a hierarchy set up. And it's not that competition is bad. I think competition is ultimately can be very healthy, but it can also have a dark side. And we never talk about the dark side of it. And in science, the field that I'm an expert in and know most about, compared to other subjects that I know less about, is we are really venerating this prize above almost everything else. And the fact that it's really so subjective, it's so far strayed from what it was originally intended to do 100 plus years ago, and it's now morphed in such a way that it's affecting the way that science is perceived, not only by the public, which is bad enough, but by how scientists themselves see it and how they view and their committees that give them tenure and their funding agencies are guided in part by the precedent set by previous Nobel Prizes. And I think that's very dangerous.
Absolutely. And again, you know, since I have so many Nobel Prize winning scientists that are personal friends of mine in the audience, no, I'm kidding. but in truth, I would not want to try and take away from the achievement of those who have actually been awarded the prize. It is, however, my intention, and I think yours in the book, to illustrate that this should not be the thing that drives people. And this should not be the thing that inspires people to pursue certain avenues of science. Because again, as you outline in the book, and for those who might be interested in reading it, again, that book is titled Losing the Nobel Prize by Brian G. Keating. But one of the key elements that you illustrate is how only certain areas of science tend to fall into those categories most likely to receive awards. But there are so many others that wouldn't be on the Nobel radar, so to speak, which are so fundamentally important to not only making life better on this planet right now, or perhaps studying other life and the potential for its existence elsewhere, or even, you know, ensuring help to ensure the future of humanity as we know it. I mean, many of these kinds of existential concerns, when we get into the nuances and the areas of science that can affect all these things, you simply don't see all of them qualifying for what would be that landmark Nobel achievement. And that too is concerning because I worry that many scientists, many gifted professionals will not pursue those areas if they do not feel that there will be the potential for that payoff in the end.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's a very complicated question to unpack. But I'll say, you know, my book is really a memoir of what it's like to aspire to do great science, to observe something that's not been observable before, and really to also, as I candidly admit, to win this gilded medallion, because as it is currently, or when I began it, the writing of this book and even my scientific career, you know, began almost under the shadow of the Nobel Prize for the discovery of gravitational waves emanating from a pair of pulsars in a distant part of our galaxy. And this fascinated me that this person who had won the Nobel Prize that year was the same age as me when he discovered this finding that would later lead to his Nobel Prize. Namely, he was 21 or 22 years old when he started to make these discoveries. And I thought, well, maybe I can do that too. And then in my department was a Nobel laureate, Leon Cooper. And later there'd be another Nobel laureate there. And just the fawning, the attention, the pride that Brown took in having these eminent scientists there. And again, you're absolutely right. I don't take anything away from the winners. They don't choose themselves. In fact, right. I was asked to nominate the winners of the Nobel Prize the year after I basically had to retract the discovery that could have
won.
And that nomination, which they asked me to keep strictly confidential. So I ask your listeners not to mention this to anybody. Sure. But even though it's in my book. But nevertheless, the award that ended up going out, that to me was almost sort of a humiliation, but it was also a chance to work on my own humility.
Yeah.
Because I realized I had aspired to this so much and that I wouldn't win it, and yet they were still asking me for my advice as to who should win it. And I start to think, amidst all this, I looked at one of the rules and regulations that they asked me to abide by, and the one that they very prominently displayed was, you can't nominate yourself. So, ultimately, that the person who wins it, it wasn't some self-dealing. That doesn't mean that their PhD advisor or their former boss or their former students can't nominate them. That happens all the time. And you see rich family trees of Nobel laureates, so to speak. But nevertheless, they pretty much almost always get it right. The problem is who they leave out. So they get some people that are necessary, for example, to receive the award, but they don't get all the ones that were sufficient to make the award possible. And for that reason, I predict the Nobel's days are numbered, because science is not done by three people anymore. It's my team of the Simons Observatory, which I'm the leader of, is the 260 brightest people on the planet. And I say candidly in the book, now I explicitly saying right now that I should not win the Nobel Prize, and we should not win the Nobel Prize if we're successful, meaning that we're looking for something, and that one or two or three people are not adequate for this discovery to be made. And I think that's really true. And I also say, if they want to see if I'm sincere, they should offer me the Nobel Prize. And if I don't turn it down, then I'm a hypocrite.
That's a very noble thing of you to say. Brian, I do want to actually get some updates about what's happening there at the observatory. But first, I have to ask you this, because we have talked in the past, and we even mentioned it briefly earlier today, that you've gotten some pushback from colleagues. There is such a thing as the Sagan effect, where, and in fact, there's a great blog about this at my friend Dr. One Pagan's website. If you go online, search for One, like the word one, Pagan, and he writes about the Sagan effect. This is, of course, in reference to Carl Sagan and what happens when science educators get out there and they are promoting science and education to the public. Sagan really saw a lot of pushback because for some reason there appeared to be this perceived diminishing of his efficacy as a scientist by virtue of being a popular communicator on this subject. And many would actually just chalk it up to being professional jealousy when they see a person who has published a book or they go on television and they are promoting broader science awareness rather than simply publishing papers. Now, you have done a lot of both. Do you feel that this sort of an idea, a Sagan effect, could be in any way associated with some of the pushback you've received?
Yeah, I love talking to you because you ask me questions that no one's asked me in the 2 years I've been. But you're absolutely right. And it is very perceptive to note that. So I have written close to 200 scientific papers. Mm-hmm. And these papers have been cited by other scientists and collaborations thousands and thousands of times, meaning that they've read my work and said that my work in some small way or maybe a large way contributed to the particular branch of research that they're working on. That's how science is done. No one does science by his or herself. We're all standing on the shoulders of the giants that preceded us, and we all have an obligation to teach those that come after us. And part of the currency of science is your so-called citation count. So don't think that only podcasters worry about counting downloads and things like that. For scientists are obsessed with this. In fact, we not only have statistics, we have statistics of statistics. So in other words, we have not only how many people have cited a particular paper, but then we say, of those papers that have been cited, how many have been cited a certain number of times, and so on and so forth. And you can make statistics of statistics of statistics. It can really drive you nuts. And of course, you know, if scientists can do this, they're going to do and every conceivable form of analysis. How many papers have been read by 10 people before the scientists turn 30 years old? There's a statistic for that.
You know, are you kidding?
No, I'm not joking. And your ability to get promotions depends on some of these statistics as a professor in a research university like UC San Diego or any of the other top universities in the world. And so what I find so fascinating is that for all those citations, you know, close to 10,000 citations of my papers, and I'm very gratified for each and every one because it meant somebody had to sit through and read through the, you know, it could be a 30-page paper, which could take, you know, weeks to get through and go through peer review and get validated, et cetera, et cetera, that they took the time for that. In contradistinction, you know, my book's been read, you know, 20,000 people and all around the world, and not scientists alone. And it's been read by scientists. Some of the most eminent scientists in the world not only read my book, but endorsed it. Sir Roger Penrose, Lord Martin Rees, Brian Greene. I mean, these [S2] Wow. [S1] Are the most phenomenal scientists in the world. And they read and they sat down with my ideas. And some of them gave me the highest compliment that scientists can give me, which is that I learned something from you. And these are people that created my field. They're telling me that they learned something from little old me, this kid who, you know, didn't have any special advantages, you know, grew up relatively poor and had, you know, low access to a very small public school in New York. And still, I went on through the help of my wonderful mentors in both the scientific pursuit and in writing. I've had wonderful mentors in writing. Katie Fries, Lisa Randall, Brian Greene, Martin Rees, all these wonderful – it just blows me away. And so you're right. It's a question of impact. I don't think that – you know, the people that hate, you know, are going to hate me anyway. I think some people come off negatively in the book, and you know, I tried to keep it as honest as possible, and it is as completely honest and thoroughly researched as could be, but it's inevitable people will kind of have negative associations with it. Some people, though, pay me the highest compliment. I told you what scientists have said that just warmed me so much. But then I've had non-scientists tell me that this book, you know, changed their life and that influenced how they handle things in business or how they teach things to their daughters. And it just those kinds of things I would never get from a scientific paper. I mean, very few scientific papers can be said to change somebody's life and the layperson's life.
Yeah, although I wish that they could. And I think it's important because you're outlining the multifaceted element here and the importance of science educators. A person who writes a popular science book reaches so many more people than that paper will. But then again, you might call the scientific peer review publication process the gold standard of science. This is how we do the best work that we can. And it is no man as an island. I mean, this has to be a mutual, a cumulative effort. Now, that reminds me of something else I'd like to ask you about, Brian, because a number of years ago, the editor of the Lancet Journal had written an article talking about how much of what his own journal published, he felt, was borderline pseudoscientific in the sense that he thought that the peer review process at times had been corrupted by a sort of buddy system in science where some scientists, this doesn't always happen, but some scientists would take for granted discoveries made by their peers without actually properly reviewing the data because, well, we know this person's work and therefore we assume it is likely to be, you know, complete and accurate. That may not always be the case, as the editor had complained in an actual journal entry that he himself wrote, which calls into question a number of issues. Do some of the same problems perhaps that we see with regard to the Nobel system, would you say that those apply to the scientific process and specifically to peer review itself?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's this perception that peer review is some sort of panacea that, you know, by employing it, that sort of guards against any potential, you know, detrimental aspect of research. For example, a lot of large institutions like NASA will not have a press conference on some new finding of an exoplanet or life on discovered in a meteorite has happened, unless those results are peer reviewed and accepted for publication in a journal. And it could be a very prestigious journal, or it could be, you know, an ordinary, more less impactful, as we say, journal. Mm-hmm. But there's plenty of examples where that's happened and the peer review has taken place. And indeed, the results had to be retracted. And I always point out, you know, the results always appear on the front page of the New York Times. And then the retraction, if they ever appear, is always on page, you know, B32, you know, some months or years later. And I think that's actually a significant lacuna and a failure of scientists, that we basically don't handle our flaws in public. And so the public is left either with a misapprehension of that science was reported as always correct, or they're left with the impression that scientists never make mistakes. And neither one of which is true, because scientists are human beings. And right. As long as human beings do science, we are going to make mistakes. And so I think we should, you know, reserve some funding in some sense for our grants to deal with these ethical issues in science and present our, you know, our true exposure to how science is actually done. So it's for our benefit ultimately that we are perceived as engaging in a human endeavor. And part of the reason I think people think of science as so daunting is because they see that they believe that scientists never make mistakes. And because of that, they are left with this, again, this misconception that we are not like other people. And if they don't feel like they are incapable of making mistakes, then they feel like they can't be scientists. So we probably do ourselves a disservice. We drive people away from science that could otherwise be a part of it because of this air of invincibility.
Yeah, I am so glad you're brave enough to say things like that. And it's very important, I think, in the broader scientific dialogue. But, you know, talking about science, what's going on right now? What have you got going on there at the Simons Observatory? Let's get an update about that.
So the Simons Observatory is perhaps the most ambitious cosmological telescope ever designed. It's actually a series of an array of four telescopes that work independently of each other to look at the sky as perceived by this radio or microwave emission that comes to us in all directions called the cosmic microwave background radiation. This signal is the leftover thermal imprint of the formation of the very first elements in the universe 13,800,000,000 years ago. And because of that, it's the oldest light in the universe, so it travels through all of space and time. And in particular, it may encode within it the properties of what makes our universe tick. What is our universe made of? How long has our universe existed for, and how long may it continue to exist for? The most interesting question of all, in my opinion, in cosmology, is what happened on the Tuesday before the Big Bang. In other words, what was preceding our universe? How does time progress from a non-being of time, from the non-existence of time, and then time suddenly springing into existence? How could that be possible? We are attempting to understand that. And along the way, to glean insights into the very deepest inner workings of the universe, how the universe is built, what is it comprised of, what are the particles, forces, and fields that hold our universe together and are blowing it apart simultaneously. And so to me, it's the most fascinating thing to do, and to have the ability to work with 260 of the brightest minds on all seven continents is just such a delight and a treasure for me that it's one thing to do what you love, and it's another thing to be able to do what you love with people you love. And that's the way I feel, you know, just so engaged and so passionate about this science. So people are interested. You can look us up at simonsobservatory.org, or we have a YouTube channel, Simons Observatory, in addition to all the stuff I usually post on social media, et cetera.
Yeah, and I know it's not out yet, but I did hear that there is a paperback edition of your book coming out later this month. Where can people find this book?
Yeah, so it's available. It should be available pretty much in every bookstore. It goes on sale officially on the 24th of September, 2019. So by the time this airs, it should be available either for actual order or pre-order. And I urge people to, you know, sign up for my mailing list, because I do a lot of giveaways, a lot of swag. I give away bookmarks with gold-plated images of Alfred Nobel on them, and I give away meteorites and sometimes even a lunar sample or two that I've collected in all my expeditions all over the planet. So it's a book, again, that's not really a book about the Nobel Prize per se. It's more about how the Nobel Prize loomed over me and caused me to reevaluate not only what does it mean to be a scientist, but also what it means to leave a legacy, because Alfred Nobel endowed the most famous will in history, and in so doing created the Nobel Prize, and he died childless and without a spouse, and this legacy is all that he left, and how it got distorted is important, and I do describe that in 3 of the 13 chapters, but the rest are really about the legacy that I urge everybody to do. I say, you know, at one point, you know, write your will, write your ethical will. What do you want people to know about you? What gifts of the mind and the spirit do you want to give? Not just your monetary wealth, but what about your intellectual wealth do you want to go and give on? So I say, write that down a year before you die. That's what Alfred Nobel did. So you don't know when you're going to die. So write it down today.
Absolutely. And it's a very personal reflection that you offer in your book. I highly recommend it. Losing the Nobel Prize. We might have to get you back on at some point for some more SETI updates. And I really appreciate you taking time to join us on this edition of the Micah Hanks Program. Thanks again, Brian. Let's have you back.
I would love to. Mitch, it's always such a treat to be on with you.
Well, the pleasure is ours. I'm sure it won't be the last time we have you on. Again, thanks to Dr. Brian Keating for joining us on this edition of the program. Thanks to all you guys who tune in and listen as well. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah are Race Hobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.